This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
Okay, known online as Escape. Thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Thank you for hosting me.
Where do you want to escape to or from?
Conditional finance. I think that's the biblical mark of the beast. As incredible as it sounds, they're implementing it right this very second.
What, the digital receipts. Mark of the beast?
Yeah, basically, kind of it fundamentally comes down to conditional finance, where the central bank digital currencies, through the Bank for International Settlements Innovation Hub Project Rosalind, have got a three-party lock. That's one of the functions. So Project Rosalind is one of the Innovation Hub projects, kind of, and it details sort of the API. And in that API, there's a function which is essentially locking a quantity of money, kind of basically kind of with a third-party lock. So under normal circumstances, like say, for instance, basically, kind of, I bought a bought a pint of milk from you. My central bank wallet, digital currency wallet, would effectively lock the amount of money kind of you would receive kind of for the good. And then it would sort of send a code to your wallet and your wallet would accept it and the money would just transfer. But they've implemented a functionality for a three-party lock. And the third party is essentially an organization or any kind of institution which would validate whether the transfer should go ahead. And this is an obvious place to check whether you've got sufficient amount of carbon dioxide, carbon emission credits in your sort of secondary or tertiary sort of bank account. And if you don't, then, you're presented with the option that either you cannot go forward with the transaction, as in I can't buy the, pint of milk or whatever kind of is from you, or your system sort of says, but you have to pay extra taxes, and consequently, the good will effectively become more expensive from our perspective, which effectively, if you think about it, that's a social credit system.
Okay, so, we've jumped right into this, but let's just make sure that we've got absolute clarity here. So when you talk about central bank digital currency and they, like, let's just break these apart quickly.
Right. Yeah, there would be. So in the sense of the central banks, they cooperate through the Bank for International Settlements. The Bank for International Settlements have got an innovation hub, which is effectively a bunch of research projects. One of the research projects is basically, Project Rosalind, which details an API with a number of functions, and that's where the programmable currency comes into play. Now, a number of central banks themselves, like the ECB, Bank of Israel, the Swedish central bank, they've all detailed conditional payments, where effectively kind of basically a payment becomes conditional upon some sort of external, some sort of external validation. And that's effectively what I'm saying, kind of like this external validation and this sort of conditional payment effectively built on the three-party lock, basically in Project Rosalind. So consequently, kind of the Bank for International Settlements can claim that they're not the ones doing this. But it's kind of like, loading the gun and placing it right in front of of an armed killer. Kind of, it's sort of right. Okay, they're definitely influential in this regard. Let's put it that way. But by and large, the Bank for International Settlements creates a bunch of research projects, which the individual central banks then will implement, and then everything will just integrate kind of based through, other projects, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, this has been gradually rolling out around the world. I've seen a couple phases of this here in South Africa. But now explain what's going on in the US, where Trump is. They made a big hoo-ha about him being opposed to it and rather introducing stable coins.
Okay, that's somewhat a bit of a break kind of from that conversation. With regards to what's happening in the United States, kind of, I'd rather focus kind of basically on the Stargate AI, because that's from essentially kind of the thing which really matters over there. The way I see effectively this entire structure is that essentially they implement it in small steps here, there, and everywhere, right? But in different order. Mm. And basically, kind of like the European Union has got one track and United States has got a different track. And the track United States is on is effectively basically as the provider of the sort of technocracy, so to speak. So a lot of essentially the AI Stargate initiative is essentially by building a colossal digital twin, which will model the entire world on basis of all available sort of global surveillance information. So that means real-time satellite streams kind of via sort of Elon Musk's spy satellites that he's placing into orbit for the intelligence community, as well as kind of basically all mobile phones, social media sites, you know, city IoT sensors, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All that information gathering kind of goes through basically a number of organizations. Palantir, of course, is one of them. And effectively, basically, that's all rooted into the sort of Stargate AI initiative, which will be used to sort of predict the future. And basically, then effectively, through this future prediction, they will model sort of a policy response. And that policy response will primarily be railed through essentially conditional finance. And that's sort of the point, because the EU is focused on one part of that pipeline and the United States is focused on a different part of that pipeline. So, yeah, basically, I mean, essentially all this sort of technology is going in everywhere. It's just a question of, you know, ordering.
Okay, wait. So CBDCs and stablecoins are not really different.
Well, stablecoins effectively kind of basically getting is a sense of one-to-one backing kind of basically of a particular asset or whatever. But basically, that's not really what I'm focusing on here. We can talk about kind of basically sort of dual split, kind of basically cut off the future sort of CBDC or the wholesale retail split, basically of the central bank digital currency. Basically, but what I'm talking about here is really just the architecture itself in regards to how this will function, kind of from the retail perspective, how it will look to you and I, basically.
And is it inevitable?
It's not inevitable. It's not inevitable. I get a lot of comments on Substack sort of saying, "Oh, woe is us" and stuff like that. I don't think it's inevitable at all. I think we're kind of up against it, kind of basically in the sense that the timeline is fairly short, right? Because digital ID basically will go through European Union very soon. In 2026, the legislation will pass or come into force, kind of basically where every citizen of the EU basically will have a digital ID effectively. Now, in addition to that, kind of there's also another bit of legislation which is going through, which no one is talking about, is the carbon CBAM, kind of basically carbon-based adjustment mechanism, something along those lines. I wrote about it quite recently. Basically, kind of what that in effect does is that it mandates for every imported good, it should have metadata for every imported good, where effectively, you know, for each individual item, it'll have a description of so much carbon dioxide was emitted during the during the development of this input, you know, this imported good. But the point here is that it's not just the carbon dioxide emitted kind of for the final stage of that pipeline, it's for the entire pipeline itself. So that means effectively kind of if you import like a radio or whatever, the metadata would include information about basically how much carbon dioxide was produced, was used kind of basically in the production of that radio through the entire supply chain. So that in effect means kind of basically you have a carbon cost for every imported item, basically kind of in the EU by CBAM, right? Now, initially, it only relates to 70 products, but they're already talking about basically broadening by another 300 or something along those lines, right? And once we've got 370, obviously, they're just going to broaden it until it's on every single import, right? And once it's at the stage of kind of basically covering every single import throughout the entire European economy, kind of the next step is obviously just moving it straight down to the retail level. So effectively, every single time you go down to the shop, you will know exactly kind of how much a pint of milk imported from Poland or whatever have cost in terms of carbon emissions. And that's sort of the point, because basically if you have a central bank digital currency and you've got a number of, you have a carbon allowance in that regard, kind of, you know, basically one thing is the cost of that milk, but if your carbon sort of balance kind of basically does not allow you to buy that pint of milk, the supermarket like Sainsbury's might sort of say, no, you can't afford to buy this, or you cannot buy this because your central bank, your carbon emission credits kind of basically are sort of negative if you buy this. So either we're going to tax you a little bit more, so you have to pay another 10p in order to buy that pint of milk, because that way you pay for your carbon emissions, blah, blah, whatever. I mean, this is all theoretical, of course, because it's all bollocks. But anyway, or the alternative is essentially you can buy this you know, environment friendly, you know, sort of cockroach milk, basically, you know, whatever disgusting substitute they have in mind for you. And you might think this sounds crazy, right? Kind of basic, but it's not that far off, because basically, kind of, if you go down to some supermarket chains in the UK, they will remind you of your carbon, allowance, effectively. Yeah, no, it's basically kind of like they have to go there slowly, so they will not tell you about your footprint. They will tell you about your allowance. You're allowed a certain amount of carbon. And if you go to your bank account, like if you're with NatWest, for instance, they keep track of essentially kind of how much carbon dioxide you have essentially spent through your purchases. So we're not far off the stage where essentially the final few things just sort of all connect to one another. All these sort of separate steps, which will eventually connect, they're all in motion, all of them. So it's just a question of time before they all lock. But it's in 2026 is quite a big year, because CBAM comes through in January and Digital ID comes through in EU as well. I mean, essentially there are obviously more steps to it, basically, but 2026 is a fairly major year.
Well, we'll talk about that in a second, but carbon. So sustainable development is basically the whole purpose of the UN and the IPCC. So is everything about that? Do all roads lead to carbon emissions?
No, it's not just carbon emissions, but carbon emissions is the most obvious one, because that's the one they've basically spent since at least 1968, the 1968 UNESCO Biosphere Conference, regards to establishing kind of this environmentalism nonsense, right? Now, from our perspective, essentially, it's possible that the climate is changing, but the quantity of material you'd need to simulate in order to comprehend whether that is actually happening is just so vast that there's no way we can do it, right? It's sitting projecting 90 years into the future on basis of a tiny, tiny, tiny little bit of a total material kind of basically simulated, basically, is completely absurd. But the most visible, obviously, one is CO2, right? Kind of is. But once we're with CO2, all these mechanisms are effectively being created, not specifically for carbon dioxide. Kind of basically, they're created kind of for any input, really. So that means when we speak of essentially the Bank for International Settlements Project Rosalind, the three party lock sort of function, basically, kind of the third party which approves your process might not just be one party. It might be sort of a container of parties where one will take your carbon dioxide, your emission credits, right? And another one will determine kind of basically kind of where you are in regards to sort of social justice, whatever, kind of if this is, you know, culturally inappropriate for you to buy whatever ridiculous nonsense, right? And a third one could be basically kind of, well, are we in a health emergency? Then you're not allowed to buy certain sets of goods, as we saw during COVID, right? So effectively, kind of, the three-party lock essentially is a blank check for basically kind of, telling you kind of you can't buy X, Y, Z for any reason. And the three-party lock kind of basically there it applies to each individual transaction, right? It's literally per transaction. So if I buy a pint of milk with you, the check will be, you know, executed on that. But it also operates kind of basically in terms of like from an enterprise perspective, right? Where businesses, basically they have to adhere to ESG regulation and CSR, blah, blah, blah. Now, a lot of this stuff is voluntary, right? Kind of basic, but these sort of things, you know, always tend to be sort of like, yeah, they're initially voluntary, but once after a certain period of time, they sort of gradually shift towards, you know, mandatory, right? So that doesn't necessarily mean that they're by force, right? Kind of, but what they will do basically in terms of enterprise is just to make sure that if you refuse basically sort of ESG legislation, then it will cost you twice as much money to raise money on the financial markets, which obviously basically is, you know, you might as well, you know, commit suicide financially, right? Kind of, no large enterprise will do that because they're all deeply embedded kind of basically in the financial markets. You know, if Coca-Cola tomorrow kind of had to pay like, you know, 10% interest rate kind of basically on debt as opposed to 2%, kind of, you know, sort of it would be financial suicide for them to do it. So it's just essentially kind of just sort of gradually forcing this through kind of basically through every sort of avenue. So you have the individual through you know, the conditional payment CBDCs, right? Kind of, you have essentially the enterprise through various sort of levers, including sort of the cost of debt. But you also have the sovereign nations, where you can see, for instance, Ukraine right now. They're in the middle of, you know, they're in a, obviously basically in a state of emergency, and states of emergency are really great from a perspective of wanting to push through egregious legislation, which is exactly what's taking place right now, because basically they've instituted a framework where everything has gone digital, and everything effectively, every payment is essentially conditional upon a set of terms. So it's basically, it's this sort of conditional architecture which has been rolled out, not just through the individual, or it will be rolled out through the individual soon enough, but also through the corporate and through essentially the sovereign. So everyone is dependent upon essentially, basically adhering to, you know, whatever the requirements are. And so, you know, whoever sets those requirements are effectively kind of basically the navigator of Spaceship Earth, so to speak.
Well, who created the architecture?
Well, that's sort of, you have to go back to 1966, where Kenneth Bolding posts a paper called The Economics of the Future Spaceship Earth. And basically kind of what he's describing is a closed loop general systems theory model of the entire planet. the best way probably to understand it, I mean, this is a simplified version, of course, but it's very easy to understand it that way, right? You have three component fundamentally in adaptive management, right? You have general systems theory, which is a model of whatever you try to understand or manipulate, right? Then you have input-output analysis, which is effectively an understanding of flow within that model, right? And then you have cybernetics, which is effectively the conscious manipulation of that flow in order to, you know, create kind of some sort of outcome, right? If you equate that to the veins of your body, the veins of your body is essentially the general systems theory model. That's where the blood can sort of flow around, right? Then you have the input-output analysis that essentially can revolves around the blood actually flowing in those veins. And the cybernetics would effectively be you trying to consciously manipulate the flow of blood within those veins in order to get some, in order for you to move your arm or whatever. I mean, I this obviously simplified kind of basically, but it's very good and very easy way of understanding what how it effectively works. So when you speak of Spaceship Earth, you speak of a closed loop sort of general systems theory model, right? And by a closed loop, that effectively means just much like the veins in your body, they're also closed loop, because otherwise the blood would spill out somewhere. And fundamentally, kind of, that's what that is what Kenneth Bolding discussed in that 1966 paper, and that then became circular economy, because essentially, kind of, instead of measuring blood, you can measure kind of basically the flow of credit, basically, you know, money kind of through the system, or you could measure metals or energy, anything really. Kind of, it's just a matter kind of having that Excel sort of system where you can model everything kind of and analyze everything. And that's fundamentally where you then get to in our contemporary world. We have basically kind of, we have standards organizations like ISO and OECD basically sort of telling us kind of basically what's of importance to be measured. And then we have the digital ID, which doesn't apply just to the individual, but also kind of basically to enterprise and any nation, any aspect of a system will effectively kind of basically have an asset tag, is how I would like to consider them. And then basically the third aspect of the general systems theory model is the accreditation, which effectively kind of is telling, is sort of a database of information about who is allowed to transact with everyone else. So for instance, if you consider it from the economic perspective, then basically the accreditation will dictate whether I'm allowed to buy a pint of milk from you, because it might be that we're just not allowed to basically exchange money whatsoever, right? So that's the general systems theory model itself. You have basically through these three. Then in the input-output analysis basic aspect, kind of basically we have a sense of the data, which is basically global surveillance. You know, it could be literally anything. Kind of, you know, your Facebook feed, whatever, anything. Kind of basically, it's just any input of data, right? Kind of basically, which obviously relates to all the IDs which are in the system. Then you have the audit basically as well, which effectively you take the data and you have the model, and then you can sort of see, did people do what they're expected to do? Is that a legit sort of transaction or behavior pattern? And those two together, data and the audit, is essentially is the input-output analysis, which basically kind of models the flow of, in this particular case, kind of basically money, but it could be applied to a set metals or energy, whatever, kind of, right? And then the final aspect kind of basically kind of is essentially you have effectively a procurement rail, and We'll get back to that in a second because it takes that's a little bit long, a little bit more complicated to explain, kind of basic. And then you have finance itself, which is the actuator, and that's where the conditional finance comes in. Because essentially, if you're a good boy and you've carried out, done what exactly you were supposed to do and you haven't broken any rules, then basically every trade, like I can buy that pint of milk from you. The procurement is a little bit more complicated, right? Because basically what it's all nice and dandy having this sort of complex system, but if no one adheres to it, kind of like, you know, sort of, it's not really worth anything. And that's where procurement comes in. What procurement effectively is essentially any state expenditure forces alignment with this sort of system. And when you think of United Nations, kind of, they do a lot of business with public-private partnerships, kind of, you know, with large enterprise. They all want a piece of that pie, of course. So they all adhere kind of basically to this sort of system, basically, which allows for adaptive management, right, through the sort of conditional finance. But the small and medium-sized enterprises, they will be forced in line, basically, through large enterprise having the expectation that all their inputs also adhere kind of to the same structure. And of course they will do that, because otherwise kind of they miss out on all those lucrative contracts. And what that in effect means kind of basically is that the entire system will align to the same structure and a set general systems theory, kind of basically in the input-output analysis, and then basically actuated through the cybernetic financial sort of lever, effectively enables adaptive management. So when we go back to, Kenneth Boulding, kind of basically what he was effectively talking about, kind of basically was a planetary scale adaptive management system, basically. That's fundamentally kind of what it comes down to. And that's basically what we're building right now, where the primary actuator runs straight through finance. It's all about kind of basically conditional finance. If you're a good boy, you do what you're supposed to do, kind of basically, essentially, then you're allowed to buy a pint of milk. And if you're not, then I'm afraid you're just going to have to go home and you can't buy anything and you can't feed your kids. So, you know, everyone effectively will be forced in line. That's what they plan on doing.
Is this a new idea, or is it an old idea that just was never able to be implemented?
That's a very good question, basically. So if you start going through Marx, in Das Kapital, he starts speaking about basically producer-consumer relations, and CBDCs, basically with conditionality, is effectively that, where effectively you can stop individual sort of transaction, basically center at the individual producer-consumer sort of connection, right? But in addition to that, he also speaks in Fragment on Machines about basically the future sort of what's called automation of society, right? And in general, I mean, a lot of kind of basically Marxist writings, Marx and Engels's writings, they come back to kind of basically there's one big gaping hole kind of basically into our ideology, right? We have the 10 planks, of which the fifth plank kind of basically is about, you know, monetary sort of centralization of all credit in one central bank, effectively, right? But there's one big gap, right? Because this describes an intermediate state where effectively, the dictatorship of the proletariat will sort of come to be, basically. Kind of, again, that's supposedly a works dictatorship. Mm-hmm. But that's only a sort of temporary sort of station. And the ultimate sort of end station is essentially, you know, kind of this paradise, kind of basically where the state just naturally withers away. And if you read like this, kind of, I mean, it's complete, it's just, it's kind of ridiculous, right? Because he spends so much time sitting analyzing and critiquing, you know, the existing system, right? But basically, when it comes to describing how you go from the middle stage to the final stage, there's virtually no information. But if you go to Lenin in 1918, he speaks of accounting and control. And what accounting and control is effectively surveillance and auditing, right? And that's basically the system kind of they tried to implement kind of basically in Soviet Russia. It's obviously enormously it's not great, basically, obviously, because they don't have the technology that we have today, right? And then a little bit down the road, kind of basically find technocracy, kind of start discussing essentially exactly the same system, just from the perspective kind of basically of energy tracking, right? But we also have kind of basically one person who's probably one of the least covered people, in sort of history, really, kind of basically, and that is Alexander Bogdanov, who co-founded the Bolshevik Party with Lenin in 1903. And he came up with something called Techtology. And what Techtology effectively is a precursor to general systems theory. But in addition to that, he also described complex supply chain analysis, which effectively is input-output analysis. And Leontief almost certainly kind of basically had access to his papers before he left Russia, basically, right? And Leontief is essentially the man who became famous for developing input-output analysis. So effectively, you have kind of basically both the input-output analysis aspect and the general systems theory aspect. They both come back kind of basically to the same person. Alexander Bogdanov. And essentially, again, Bogdanov's primary, basically he was a Marxist, right? Kind of basically, but he fundamentally disagreed with Marx in the sense that he abhorred any kind of sort of violence. Kind of he wanted it to be sort of a Fabian smooth transition to sort of scientific socialism. And basically kind of that was essentially what his system enabled. Kind of because you don't really notice this is going in basically by everyone in society, kind of this creeping sort of system of conditional finance basically is already in operation. Like, for instance, basically, if you go to the G77 and World Development Aid, this system essentially has been in place kind of since the 1970s. Like, you know, basically, if third-party nations, they don't do as they're expected to kind of in their sort of project papers, kind of basically, then they will not receive the next tranche of aid. And it's very simple, kind of basically. In other words, they don't really have an option. They have to go along with this. Otherwise, kind of, they will not get development aid and kind of half the population might starve, you know. So it's sort of, they can't really refuse. And it's interesting because I also trace back kind of basically how this sort of system worked, you know, came to be. Kind of basically, I said they place it through development aids, and it's originally based on McNamara's PPBS, which was instituted basically through the Department of Defense in 1961. And that then scaled kind of basically through Third World Development Aid. And today, basically, kind of if you read on funding kind of projects through United Nations, you'll find result-based management with KPIs, which is basically the same system just developed, you know. It's literally everyone.
So is this a natural progression of technology, or is this a sort of more nefarious design with other motives?
I can answer that very, very simply, kind of basically. Let me just find it, kind of because basically I went through this quite recently, right? Let me see if I can find it, right? Kind of so we had the most ridiculous sort of list of things basically kind of which took place I had to do it from memory, right? So in 1987, we had the Montreal Protocol. And what the Montreal Protocol basically related to was ozone, right? Kind of basically kind of the ozone layer apparently being destroyed. But what no one really discussed was basically in the Montreal Protocol, there was specific language relating to swapping emission permits. And no one really discussed at that point in time because it wasn't monetized or anything like that, right? So this is 87. 1988, the IPCC comes to be, right? And in the same year, almost as soon as basically the IPCC came to be, then the New York Times basically on its front page announced that kind of, you know, global warming has officially started. It's like, it's just like, how lucky for us, kind of basically IPCC just came into being in the same year, right? And then in 1989, we had a G7 summit. And basically, that's where the FATF, Financial Action Task Force, came to be, right? And basically, kind of what the FATF does is that they prosecute financial crime, like you know, money laundering and stuff like that. Kind of basically, but their mandate has strangely come to include even our environmental crime, basically over the past few years. And if you look at the 1989 papers coming from that summit, from which FATF came to be, kind of basically, they also spoke about environmentalism at a point in time where, you know, no one had any idea this was going to be fused into finance, which is just a little bit odd, right? Kind of basically. And then they also spoke about debt for nature swaps, which were like kind of, you know, how the hell they could have focused on debt for nature swaps at this point in time is just absolutely astonishing. But and then basically in 1990, the IPCC in Working Group 3, they discussed kind of basically kind of how to create a system for trading carbon you know, carbon emission permits, basically. Okay? So they didn't sit still. Within 2 years of existing, they're already outlining how the future trading system will come to be. And in 1991, the Global Environmental Facility came to be, which effectively is the sort of financial backstop for the Convention on Biological Diversity and the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, UNFCCC, right? And then, of course, basically, the Earth Summit, you know, in 1992, basically established kind of basically those two, UNFCCC and the CPD. But in 1992, we also had the first of two reports titled "Combating Global Warming." They're very difficult to get a hold of, these reports. Basically, kind of search for it on my Substack, kind of basically because you know, two people were, you know, managed to drum it up for me, kind of basically, and I basically kind of covered it pretty much every single page, just because they're pivotal, right? And what those two reports detail is essentially basically the future trading system of carbon dioxide. But it's not just about carbon dioxide, because basically towards the end of the first report, it says kind of, you know, the sort of, you know, air and, what does it say? Basically, air and water can no longer be presumed to be the sort of common goods that we've sort of come to rely on so far. They will have to basically have a market-based solution sort of applied, right? Where that in effect means kind of is essentially kind of they will need to be traded assets. And that's fundamental to the system which we've seen implemented kind of basically at the carbon dioxide level, basically right now, where, you know, carbon emission permits basically are traded like, you know, any other good, right? But there, the same system will be applied to any other ecosystem service, right? And basically kind of all of it, I mean, all of it is sort of in motion, right? Now, if we go back to this timeline, we have essentially from 1987 to 1992, basically just 5 years, we have this amazing sequence of the entire sort of structure, kind of basically with regards to the financial backing of it, comes to be. We have the mechanism, basically with regards to the trading. We have basically kind of, you know, the instruments, kind of basically the CBD and UNFCCC coming to be, kind of basically which will allow this, because obviously kind of what is being monetized basically initially is the carbon emissions, basically kind of credits, basically, which effectively emanate from, you know, Peruvian rainforest or whatever, kind of basically. And that's effectively monetized through basically the Global Environmental Facility. So it's just essentially, if this was a coincidence or a natural progression, basically, kind of, I mean, essentially, you would have won the lottery 100 times in a row, basically, because it's just such bollocks, right? But I mean, I can conclusively dismantle kind of basically this sort of erroneous conclusion anyway, right? Because basically, I worked in R&D for a number of years, right? And in R&D, basically, kind of you never know basically kind of what the end result will be, right? You try something, sometimes it pays off, but often it doesn't pay off, and you will basically have lost all the time, right? It's a gamble, right? Kind of against, and consequently, when you write cutting edge research reports, you expect things not to be completely perfect, right? Basically, you expect you have to go back and sort of like, okay, basically we could go in this direction with it. If you go back and read these reports like Combating Global Warming, which is cutting edge research, basically, supposedly, right? They're basically perfect. They never really had to basically fundamentally change any of it. Everything was just absolutely perfect. And from our perspective, kind of basically having worked in R&D, I'm saying kind of, it's total fucking bollocks, right? Doesn't work like that. You would basically issue kind of, okay, these corrections here from basically this article, basically in the previous issue, but that doesn't happen. And that's essentially kind of what we see again and again and again with another big case basically happening. you know, this slightly off topic kind of based, but it's the same sort of situation, right? In 1936, Keynes basically issued a general theory, right? Kind of basically, which is basically kind of the financial model kind of basically of kind of cyclical sort of fiscal policy, basically kind of that the entire world operates with right now. What no one is talking about is that basically in 1931, 1933, and 1935, the Chatham House worked on three reports which enabled the monetary policy response supporting this framework. Had those three reports not been released, then Keynes's basically a general theory kind of basically would not have really gained any traction, because it would just be, you know, hopeful basically more than anything. But they literally established kind of basically conditions for, you know, basically his general theory kind of basically become possible. And it's just, you have this magnetic alignment time and time and time again. It's just essentially kind of from the perspective of research, it's bollocks. It doesn't work like that. It does not, you know, period, basically.
So what you're saying is that there's a lot more design than emergence.
Yes, I think what they're doing is they're designing it kind of sort of like 10, 20 years ahead. And then they've got basically essentially so many sessions at the sort of Royal Institute of International Affairs and sort of Council on Foreign Relations, basically, where they're just sitting discussing and trying to attack this from every single angle. Because, I mean, don't take it away from any of these people. They're highly intelligent, basically. And obviously, you know, they, I mean, it's fantastic if you think about it. Kind of, they worked on something for, you know, basically probably best part of 200 years. And they've had a few slip-ups here and there, kind of, basically, but by and large, they're doing very well, kind of, you know. It is very impressive what they do.
I'm referring to, what's his name, Carstens, the guy who's pretty much eaten all the money.
Carstens, yeah.
Is he just a pawn?
Well, I mean, that's what I sort of hypothesized quite recently. Kind of, if you were the kind of pathologically manipulative kind, kind of, you'd probably want to install someone who attracted attention for all the wrong reasons, right? Kind of, against, you know, you can certainly make a lot of arguments about Augustin Carstens, basically, in that regard. And I do find that when I post it on the BIS, I get a lot of comments in regard. And it's kind of, you know, okay, the man is fat. Okay, get over it, right? Kind of, does that really change anything? It's like, no, it doesn't, you know. He's got an unfortunate condition, kind of, it's great. Now, can we actually talk about Project Rosalind or you know, kind of, some of the other research sort of projects, Mandela, whatever, kind of, Enbridge, whatever, kind of, basically, kind of, you know, but most people sort of are just seemingly attracted to discussing an unfortunate condition, let's put it that way.
Your Substack it's called The Price of Freedom is Eternal Vigilance. And is one of those aspects of being vigilant, adjusting how the programmable CBDCs or the programmable money works? Because you've made a few recommendations on that.
Yeah, no, you know, when I originally set up the Substack because basically kind of I was sick and tired of Twitter censorship. And I deleted my account, 6 months ago now, kind of, it's just because, I mean, it's just, for them to claim that they're free speech, it's such a joke. But originally when I started writing, kind of, basically, I didn't actually realize where I was really going, kind of, it's just a sort of, you know, something is wrong, kind of, basically, you can't quite place your finger on it, but that's obviously a feature of the system. Basically, the entire sort of point of it is they've created a system where it's incredibly difficult to decipher it all because there's so many moving parts in this sort of system. So in regards to kind of starting to make recommendations in regards to CBDCs, basically, I wrote an article recently called How to Fix CBDCs. it's kind of like, I'm not actually expecting them to implement any of those. It's more of a sort of test to see basically them ignoring it. Kind of, it's more of a pointing out that they're not going to implement this because it would basically kind of puncture the entire system. So one of the first sort of things is basically kind of the entire sort of system operates on basis of the sort of clearinghouse, which comes from the London Bank clearinghouse sort of system, basically kind of, which fundamentally placed the Bank of England on top of the hierarchy. This system is basically being brought in digitally, right? Now, so basically, kind of the way it works is essentially instead of having 1,000 banks all transact with one another, you find a bunch of intermediaries which transact with these sort of edge, the leaf nodes, and then you have essentially got all these sort of clearinghouse banks which transact with one another, but also transact with the sort of smaller banks. That's fundamentally how the system works. And then basically, Bank of England is at the top because it's their currency, right? It is a very efficient model, of course, because you only do a fraction of the amount of settling work relative to if everyone had to settle basically relative to one another. But it also essentially kind of grants the clearinghouse banks an enormous amount of power because it effectively means at any point in time they can cut off any of the small banks and those small banks will go bankrupt immediately. Or the Bank of England could in effect basically essentially cut off the clearinghouse banks themselves and they would effectively be put out of business very quickly. So it's a hierarchical structure kind of basically, which effectively is incredibly powerful and incredibly sort of efficient basically, but it comes at the cost of essentially of centralizing kind of basically all control. And basically, kind of one probably the first thing which would be shot down was basically kind of my suggestion is essentially kind of when the entire system works on basis of transferring every single bit of information in regards to all transactions, basically right up the hierarchy, because that way you can centralize on information, and that way you can you know, you can predict effectively kind of basically what you're going to do instead of whatever tomorrow, right? Kind of basically my suggestion was basically kind of that when the all the small banks kind of basically they do the settling, kind of basically they're netting out the transaction kind of basically with the clearinghouse bank, then the clearinghouse bank effectively needs to be split into two, where essentially got all the information they transmit to the clearinghouse bank, they'll be shielded off, they'll be cut off kind of basically from the flow basically further up. So the clearinghouse bank would only basically transfer sort of net flows kind of basically essentially to the system basically above, and would keep all the detail, the fine-grained information down at the lower level. And they're so obviously not going to accept this, basically, because the entire system operates basically through you know, basically essentially sort of, you know, fine-grained sort of control, basically. And that would basically kind of cut their ability kind of to, you know, to targeted censorship, et cetera, kind of basically against any individual that would cut it in half. So it's, and I had basically a number of other sort of suggestions, but that was basically the first sort of one I thought of basically. But in general speaking, kind of, I mean, this all these sort of technocratic institutions, one of the major issues with them is that no one is accountable, right? No one is ever held accountable for anything, right? So if we look at kind of basically, for instance, so the Fabian Society in 2023 published this idea, right? Whenever the Fabian Society has got an idea, you know it's not your interest. Basically, kind of what they wanted, it's called In Tandem, and I strongly suggest everyone read it, basically, because what they're in effect saying is that right now we have the central bank kind of in control of monetary policy, we have the treasury in control of fiscal policy, and instead of doing that, basically, we need to have an EPCC, an Economic Policy Central Committee, or whatever it's called. And they should affect basically kind of cooperate kind of basically all together, you know, sort of like in setting a monetary and fiscal policy at the same point in time. Now, but these groups also should include basically kind of like NGOs and sort of third parties, you know, social justice, environmental justice, sort of outfits, which are there to sort of sit and dictate kind of basically what the common good is. Of course, I mean, the trick is here kind of basically that all the sort of NGOs which are going to be involved in this process kind of basically all captured basically by the foundation class, right? But the point is basically when the conditions for this EPCC to sort of kick in, basically, as is outlined in this idea, is that basically kind of when the interest rate, or when the inflation drops below the lower bound, as in 0%, right? The argument is essentially kind of monetary policy alone cannot sort of fix the situation. Kind of basically, kind of we need the Treasury to start basically spending more money, basically ultimately on public, I don't know, build bigger statues of Keir Starmer or something, right? Basically, kind of, but what fundamentally is not discussed here is essentially kind of the organization which is responsible to make sure that this doesn't happen in the first place is the Bank of England. It's quite literally their mandate kind of is essentially like for them to ensure that inflation always stays around 2%. So if it drops down below 0%, it's the Bank of England's fault. But they, of course, basically don't mention this. No, it's someone else's fault, right? And that's fundamentally, again, one of those sort of systems designs kind of basically kind of no one is ever there to be blamed. You know, basically, as a matter of fact, they use every single crisis in order to concentrate power. It's sort of because basically, kind of, if you look at certainly the most recent sort of 30 years, kind of basically of regulation, kind of basically in the UK and many other countries, kind of they have fundamentally only shifted more and more power towards the central banks. And at no point in time have the central banks ever been held accountable for anything. So in 2008, for instance, when the entire markets crashed, kind of basically essentially kind of, you know, no one was discussing kind of, you know, or actually kind of Peter Schiff and a bunch of other Austrian sort of economists, they were talking about kind of basic base rates being too low, which is correct, right? Kind of basically by the central banks, certainly we're not going to accept responsibility for that. Of course not. Kind of basically center there beyond reproach. They're perfect, right? Which is actually ironic. But I'll come back to that. I could come back to that. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But the point is just the sense of the entire sort of technocratic structure that they've built here in super slow motion kind of basically ensures that at no point in time will anyone be held to account. Because the sort of the financial mechanism itself is one thing, right? Kind of basically, but you also need to have a sort of understanding of where we're moving, and kind of basically where we're moving is basically a sense of the telos. And the telos is essentially the first 15 sustainable development goals, which basically can broadly be split up into three sections. You have the natural resource base of land and air and water and stuff like that, right? Kind of basically, then you have at the very top, you have the human well-being, which relates to basically kind of human society. And then you have a sense of the middle layer, which is effectively ecosystem services. And basically the point they're trying to do here is they're trying to balance the amount of ecosystem services produced by the natural resource base with those consumed by the human well-being at the very top. That's fundamentally kind of what they're trying to do, right? And that can then be traced back to the 1968 UNESCO Biosphere Recommendation 3.3, kind of basically details exactly that. That humanity needs to be brought into balance with nature, basically.
You've argued fairly extensively that money needs to be user-controlled. That's obviously in opposition to central. Where does Bitcoin then fit in?
I don't know. Kind of essentially sort of Bitcoin. I've played a little bit around with it, basically, but I think it's... I don't want to sit here and make investment advice, because basically if there's one thing you should not do is take investment advice from me, right?
Let me ask the question differently. Is Bitcoin user controlled?
Yes, to an extent, basically, as long as kind of like the requirements basically are fulfilled, I suppose, because you still fundamentally expect to be, you're essentially still basically kind of like, how can I put it? You are relying on a structure being there, basically. I suppose kind of basically that's the argument continuously, isn't it? Basically by the gold bucks sort of saying, no. You know, only gold basically essentially in this sort of state where magic, kind of the entire world, basically electric grid has been taken out. You know, only gold will suffice. I don't know. I don't really think I should be the one sitting commenting on this, because this is not really... where focused basically on, but I will say one thing regards to kind of basically the programmability, right? Kind of basically that was essentially another argument in my how to sort of fix CBDCs, right? Basically, because the conditional CBDCs, basically where the conditionality, the programmability kind of is on the central bank side, is fundamentally the issue, basically. And now you can sort of think of it this way, right? Kind of is now you could program into finance or into your money, into your wallet, saying, kind of, if I receive my paycheck today, then, you know, buy steak in the supermarket, kind of otherwise buy chicken, right? So that would be me basically kind of programming, kind of, you know, my response, my financial sort of response basically by shopping in the supermarket. And you could argue kind of basically that'd be a good thing, kind of if you were allowed to sit and basically do this programming, kind of basically sure, but that's not what they want, basically. But my argument is essentially it should be flipped, so it's your programmability. It's not what they want. They want their programmability. So basically the central banks, kind of basically, and their associated actors can do the can sit and program kind of basically essentially kind of what should happen. Basically, kind of it's what they essentially seek to establish through their sort of innovation hub project is a giant financial operating system. And Project Rosalind is the sort of API programmability layer, the, you know, the sort of place kind of basically plug in your DLL or whatever. It's obviously simplified kind of basically. I'm not saying that kind of basically, but it fundamentally is what they seek to do.
How close are we to all of it?
That's a good question. Basically, I said 2026, we've got digital ID coming in. And we also have CBAM regulation, which is basically the sort of carbon cost of everything sort of aspect. So you have both the CBDC with digital ID, kind of basically you've got CBAM, and those two sort of combined kind of basically since I produced this sort of system. So those two are not terribly far away kind of basically from X being placed. But one thing is since I'm having the system in place, another thing is basically having it rolled out to the extent that it's fundamentally useful. And as it is right now, kind of basically we're probably you know, basically at the earliest, we're talking about 2030 or something along those lines, because there's quite one thing is sit and trace kind of basically kind of how, you know, fuel and metals and whatever kind of go through supply chains kind of basically and arrive in a nation through, you know, imports. In that regard, we're probably kind of basically a few years away. But basically kind of in regards to kind of basically where else we are, let me just see. I mean, I'm sitting, gathering detail kind of to write kind of sort of a monster sort of essay kind of based on Substack kind of, it's not in here. But the point is, Those two alone are probably basically essentially kind of, you know, 2030 or something along those lines, kind of basically, but that's just the technical sort of rails. We also need the full sort of infrastructure, kind of basically, because if you just implement this infrastructure without making people ready for this transition, then you might very well kind of basically have huge riots and stuff like that. And obviously, kind of, they don't want that. So another thing they're doing is basically kind of like trying to fuse in kind of basically this sort of system through effectively an ethical approach. So we speak about like the 50 SDGs 1 to 15 be the sort of telos basically of this sort of system they're trying to create, kind of like, and quite a few of those SDGs obviously kind of relate to the environment. And environment kind of basically essentially is where the IUCN comes in, and their planetary stewardship sort of, which in 2000 turned into a planetary ethic through the Earth Charter, kind of basically. And that's fundamentally the sort of like more human side, right? Kind of basically, because every number, I mean, if you're just given a number sort of saying, oh, you're emitting this amount of carbon dioxide, kind of basically, you probably wouldn't care, kind of. And most people look at the number sort of like, oh, okay. But what they in effect do is that they reframe it to be your ethical responsibility to do a certain thing. So it had to be turned into an ethical imperative. And we saw this basically kind of during COVID, where effectively basically failing to wear a mask or whatever the hell, kind of basically all that bullshit, right? Kind of basically it was all about an ethical imperative. You know, if you didn't want to take your vaccine, you wanted to kill granny and all that sort of stuff. And it's the same thing in regards to kind of basically planetary stewardship, right? Kind of where if you don't do your thing in regards to sort of saving carbon credits or whatever, kind of basically, then you will be framed as an unethical person who deserves to be censored and have his job cut, and, you know, kind of basically needs to pay twice as much for his food down the supermarket, basically, kind of because, you know, his social credit score kind of basically is so low, whatever, right? It's I mean, yeah, it all runs through finance ultimately, yeah, but basically.
Who's leading the way globally in this?
Well, that's the thing, right? Kind of basically, kind of, if you go right now, kind of basically to Google and you type basically CNN Rothschild Spaceship Earth, you'll find an article from 2019, basically, kind of David de Rothschild standing, sort of declaring himself the navigator of Spaceship Earth. And it's sort of quite astonishing. I cannot believe kind of anyone would do this, basically. It just seems like such a terrible mistake to make, right? Because As said before, kind of Spaceship Earth is a closed-loop general system steering model, kind of which allows for adaptive management, which is effectively what we see right now, right? And the actuator in that sort of system is basically financial, right? And what is the Rothschild dynasty known for? Kind of, it's just sort of like, why would you do this? It's just sort of like. So yeah, basically, kind of. But in general, kind of basically, kind of, you know, it. You see the same names again and again and again, kind of basically, essentially, you know, Rockefeller, kind of basically, obviously, in there, Carnegie is in there, kind of basically, but though he specialized more in the early sort of stages, the peace, Hague peace conferences, I should probably quickly kind of include that, basically, because one of the things which few people sort of talk about is essentially kind of, you know, you see all the United Nations agencies, they have this sort of dual split of, you have the General Assembly, which is basically democratically elected candidates, and then you have the Secretariat, right? And the split basically between the two is actually quite useful, kind of basically from their perspective, right? Because basically the democratically elected candidates, they will come and go every 4 years, right? Continuously, kind of basically, these people will come in, come out, right? So if from a sort of strategy of wanting to basically override democracy, basically what you need to do, that's very simple, kind of basically you just need to do very long-term planning, kind of basically don't plan on base of 5 years, you plan on base of 20 years, because then kind of basically the people who are there kind of basically voting for or against kind of basically certain sort of objectives in the system, they will not actually be around to see it come into fruition. And that way you will have a secretariat which is sitting kind of basically planning all this, or kind of basically have some technical committees sitting planning it for them, right? And all the people kind of basically kind of like at the sort of general assemblies, they'll be presented kind of basically kind of with these sort of drafts, basically kind of where they get to, you know, add a comma and stuff like that, right? Which seems on its own completely reasonable, right? I mean, who doesn't want to save the earth, right? Kind of basically, but what they don't, of course, speak about is that the sort of architecture is the trap, the way they want to save the earth is fundamentally kind of the sort of problem. And that's basically kind of how it, I mean, that's basically the sort of strategy, because basically kind of when you then look at Chatham House and you look at Council on Foreign Relations, basically, what do? They sit and do extremely long-term planning. That's basically kind of what they specialize in. So you'll have like agencies, kind of a CFR and Chatham House, are sitting thinking about the 20 year or 30 years, right? Then you have the Secretariat, kind of basically, and you have the General Assembly. And none's the wisest. These things very, very slowly have sort of come through into legislation. And then 20 years time down the line, kind of all of a sudden people go, where the fuck did that come from? And it's kind of like, you know, you can't hold the current basic politicians sort of accountable, because basically these initiatives kind of basically kind of came in like 20 or 30 years ago. And what they're voting for right now, kind of basically have no idea kind of basically what that's going to be used for, because obviously no one's going to tell you. So yeah, basically it's incredibly clever. Kind of, and the entire structure is very, very clever. Kind of no question about that. But it's also incredibly deceitful. Kind of, it just bears the hallmarks of, you know, the Fabian society, basically left, right, and center, basically, you know, penned a number of the key reports, including International Government from 1916, which outlines the sort of system of governance. Anyway.
It's very easy to fall into the trap of intellectualism, but the layman listening to this, what can he do?
Ask questions. Ask questions, basically. So the sort of probably one of the more weaker gaps in the system right now, kind of, like, first off, of course, basically be aware of what they're actually doing and try to understand. And again, basically kind of ask questions about everything. And that also means kind of, you know, basically go on Twitter. I mean, even me, question kind of basically everything I say. But that's the reason kind of basically why I source practically everything with primary documents, right? Because I show you exactly where it is in the document. You can download it yourself and see, right? But anyone should basically just make sure, double check for everyone else, right? But in general, basically ask questions. And by ask questions, I don't mean at the top level kind of basically of politics. And again, basically, since I strongly disagree with the use of violence and things, so please do not take that basically since as a recommendation in that regard, basically. But challenge local politicians, because as it is right now, especially in the UK, kind of is whenever you local politicians are put on the spot, they just storm out of meetings. And what does that tell me, or what does that hopefully tell basically everyone, is basically they know damn well, but they've just decided kind of essentially that, you know, kind of it's in, you know, probably his financial interest kind of basically to go ahead with some really, really awful suggestion anyway. But when you see sort of Labour councillors basically refuse to answer questions to his local, you know, sort of people, I could say Tory councillors, because I hate both parties equally. I think they're both traitorous, quite frankly. Basically, kind of then, you know, basically that's because it's a weak point, and that's basically kind of the area kind of which needs to be challenged. But I mean, in general, a lot of this sort of stuff comes from the UK, kind of basically because, you know, sort of Tony Blair's third way, kind of based from 98, kind of was the starting gun for a lot of this. But his what few people know, kind of basically, was that he, in 1991, wrote an article in Marxism Today, where he effectively kind of basically kind of was recommending sort of public-private partnerships around a social good. And the key, of course, here is essentially who dictates that social good. You know, it certainly isn't you, and certainly it isn't democratic, right? But, yeah, it's basically kind of like the former sort of Blair and Brown government was essentially a Fabian government, and the current government is a Fabian government. I mean, when they originally came to power, Keir Starmer, etc., I looked up and I found that the top 13 ministers were all members of the Fabian Society, right? So out of 403, I think it is, members of parliament, which are from Labour, about a third are members of the Fabian Society, right? So the actually statistical likelihood of this basically being organic is less than 3 in a million. And when you actually read up on the history, basically, of the Labour Party, basically, I mean, essentially what it looks like, you know, is that the Labour Party is a front for the Fabian Society. And, you know, everyone sort of goes after kind of basically individual sort of members kind of basically of the government, right? Basically, Keir Starmer or, you know, Rachel from accounts, whatever, right? I mean, kind of, but they don't really matter, because basically how it fundamentally works is basically all these parasites, they all fundamentally operate through the same channels, right? So say, for instance, we got rid of Keir Starmer tomorrow, right? Well, that's great. We would have an election and another Fabian socialist basically would come to power, basically the new prime minister. And he would, or she would be armed with fresh rhetoric. So everyone was like, oh, wow, kind of basically breath of fresh air. But fundamentally, all they're going to do is shuffle their plans a little bit around and dress it up in different verbiage and Bob's your uncle, kind of. It's nothing fundamentally is going to change, basically. Kind of, it's, yeah, it's, it's fundamentally kind of the Fabian Society, kind of which has planned a lot of these things. In fact, kind of basically, it's I've received a lot of comments about basically, oh, you know, it's the royal family, you know, basically being behind all this sort of stuff. And, you know, there have been a couple of times basically where I've sort of thought kind of basically, well, it could actually be because basically I found some papers, but ultimately I can't see it being them. Because in 1918, basically Lionel Curtis was describing how the royal family had tried to regain power and how they were systematically stripped of power, kind of in his, I think it was in the book discussing the Commonwealth. And Lionel Curtis basically said that the plan for the royal family was basically that there would be a sort of pet mascot for the entire project, right? And in 2003, the Fabian Society, I mean, there are all the problems with regards to Paul Burrell, kind of basically former butler, blah, 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 right? And in 2003, kind of basically the you know, the government sort of decided kind of, oh, right, well, let's have a look at the monarchy, right? And of all organizations they appointed to basically have a review kind of basically of the monarchy was the Fabian Society. The Fabians are completely against basically a monarchy in the first place, and they appoint them to sit and basically draft the report, which is just unbelievable, right? And I bought that report because basically I couldn't find it online, right? And in the first chapter, it basically says kind of basically we need to convert the monarchy basically to become a pet mascot, kind of obviously not in those words, but they need to become a ceremonial sort of organization, basically, kind of ends. And it then basically kind of progresses through the rest of the book, sort of saying, this is what we need to do basically in order to strip that power effectively. And when you see what's happened, kind of basically they have carried out basically a number of these things. They have stripped them of power. And I think it was in 2022, basically since the Fabian Society started talking about, it's about time we start revisiting the royal family again, basically perhaps we shouldn't have a royal family. So in other words, kind of basically essentially kind of cooperating with that report at that point in time, basically kind of postponed, potentially inevitable by 20 years, right? Now, what's also interesting is essentially kind of in 1998, the Blair government essentially reformed the House of Lords. Now, I get it, kind of basically essentially you might not necessarily agree basically kind of, with the hereditary peers. I get that, right? But the point is basically the monarchy basically essentially had its strong supporters in the hereditary, you know, amongst the hereditary peers. And the Fabian Society, I think in 1996, wrote a report basically saying strip those basically hereditary peers. And that's what they did in 1998. They reformed the House of Lords, got rid of those. And once those hereditary peers basically are gone, then essentially they can start reforming the monarchy. And that's fundamentally what they did. And it's just time and time and time again, kind of basically you see Labour announce some grand new initiative like the reform of the NHS, for instance, quite recently. And you go back just a few years and basically look through Fabian Society reports and, well, what do you know? Kind of the Fabian Society have researched exactly this just a couple of years ago. I mean, what an extraordinary coincidence. And it's just sort of, yeah, what can I say?
How can my audience follow your work? Now, you've been removed from X.
No, I actually removed myself because basically it got to the stage where effectively I'd been sitting on 10,200 something followers for a long time, right? Kind of basically, and every single time I bounce up to 10,300, it just immediately kind of popped me back to 10,200. So basically, it was just so absurd, right? But in addition to that, kind of when I tweeted something which actually sort of like kind of, you know, gained a certain level of traction, you know, sort of 100 retweets or whatever, I would go through kind of basically who had retweeted it and who had liked it. And 99% of them basically were people kind of who already followed me. So in other words, what Twitter is doing is essentially kind of making sure that new people do not see basically what you tweet. And at that point, I sort of thought, well, first off, kind of basically kind of what they actually do, what I know they do, is that they take everyone's tweets, especially libertarians, and train Grok to be a more useful tool in regards to censorship, basically, kind of, and I don't want to support that. But the other sort of thing, basically, at that point in time, I sort of thought, I keep going back to X, kind of, basically, because there's the sort of, you know, what if this will suddenly magically gain traction? It never does, of course, but you live in the hope, right? And I sort of thought, basically, after a while, I sort of thought, I waste too much time on this, kind of, basically, there's no point. I mean, I've known this for a while. So I just sort of thought, all right, I'm going to delete it, because I strongly object to their definition of free speech. I mean, give me a break.
The algorithm ghetto.
Yeah, the algorithm my ass. I mean, yeah, anyway.
Okay, so you're on Substack then?
Yes, and I'm also on Telegram, but It's my secondary channel, kind of basically. It's Substack is my primary
place. What's your Substack called?
They all have numbers, don't they? I don't know.
Yeah, I've got it. Yeah, it is. It's just Escape, AESC.
Oh, yes, yes.
So escapekey.substack.com.
Yes, escapekey.substack.com, yes. And one of the reasons, I mean, essentially a lot of these sort of like things I've noticed on Twitter, I've seen basically on Substack as well. But there's the primary difference with regards to Substack that at any point in time, if you feel like they're getting too censorious, and I don't think the intelligence community has thought this out too well, because from a gaming perspective, it makes more sense to route people to Twitter than Substack. If the censorship becomes too much to bear, kind of basically on Substack, you can control P, print to, you know, save to PDF and take all your work with you basically in 5 minutes. And I think they made a bit of a mistake there, because it would not take a long time basically for me to essentially leave Substack and set up basically elsewhere. I haven't done that so far, kind of basically, but I'm just saying, I think they have royally fucked up there. Well, they're not perfect. They are definitely not perfect.
Well, on that note, Escape, thank you for joining me in the trenches.